Bienvenidos a Data Latam, donde exploramos la industria de datos en Latinoamérica.
Muy buenas, Franz, ¿cómo estás? Muy buenas.
Muy bien, Diego, muchas gracias. ¿Y tú, Andrés, cómo estás?
Muy bien, gracias.
Andrés estuvo como entrevistado alguna vez, ahora estás como parte del grupo que está tomando una entrevista, así que buenísimo, bienvenido Andrés en este modo. Franz, ¿algo que quieras mencionar acerca de tu próximo viaje y el próximo mío después a Phoenix?
Sí, es impresionante cómo ya post pandemia estamos viajando más. Tiene que ver con cómo crece Expandia, ¿no? Lo que estamos haciendo. Esta vez a Phoenix, Arizona, en Estados Unidos, donde vamos a estar visitando, o yo voy a estar visitando clientes, y tú vienes 2 semanas después a prácticamente hacer lo mismo, a incrementar la visibilidad que tenemos ahí y ser los hosts, los anfitriones de un taller sobre inteligencia artificial y machine learning que Expantia ha dado allá con el Venture Café.
Buenísimo. Bien, así que datos por allá y ahora después vamos a circular por el mundo con quien nos acompaña hoy. ¿Por qué no contás, Andrés, muy brevemente acerca de lo que vamos a hablar hoy y ya pasamos a modo inglés y a la entrevista? Entonces, dale.
Súper. Bueno, hoy vamos a estar hablando un poquito de muchas cosas. Vamos a estar hablando con John Jensen, sobre Rust, sobre diferentes formas de adoptar este lenguaje en el ecosistema de datos, sobre ciberseguridad, sobre lo que él hace en una compañía que se llama Helsing y muchas otras cosas que se vienen.
Okay, so we turn now to English and we say, welcome, John, and sorry for the Spanish introduction.
Buenos días. Solamente oh, hablo amazing. Un poquito de español, pero hello. I'll switch to English. That's where I'm more comfortable, I think.
We would not be able to follow you in Norwegian, so I think that English is completely fine.
I think it's only fair that I now do like a 5-minute Norwegian intro, right? Just for your like two Norwegian listeners.
Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic to have you here, John. Thanks and welcome to Data Latam. Look, we usually start by asking you, where exactly are you now and what's your role in whatever company you work on, so that the audience gets acquainted with who you are?
Sure. So I have a bit of a sort of going all over the place kind of history. I'm originally from Norway and I am currently in Norway, but that's not been true for most of the period of time in between. So I grew up in Norway, and then I did my bachelor's degree in Australia near Brisbane. Then I moved to London to do my master's degree. Then I moved to Boston to do my PhD. And then I moved to Los Angeles in order to basically start working there. So I worked for Amazon there for many years. And then now I've moved back to Europe, back to Norway, and I work remotely there for a European company.
Fantastic, fantastic. Yeah. You've been in different climates and you ended up going back to the
oh,
nice.
Oh yeah, Australia and Los Angeles were both far too hot for me. I need seasons. I need the cold. You know, I want spring and fall to feel like different seasons from each other, you know?
Oh yeah, nothing like the four seasons. I agree. And by the way, in your work side of things, so you've gone from working in initially some small companies, if I understand that correctly, in Norway. Then you passed through Oracle, Aptoma, then AWS as a senior software developer engineer, and then now Helsing. Is that describing more or less what you've been doing?
Yeah, that's roughly right. So I started my career essentially as a web developer. I actually started in PHP. So I did a decent amount of work in that for quite some time. And then I worked briefly at Oracle as an intern as part of my bachelor's degree. And that was actually more on the sort of formal verification, model checking type stuff. And then, you know, I did my PhD. And then after that, when I started at AWS, I worked on the Rust build infrastructure for all of AWS. So basically all Rust projects built at Amazon. So all Amazon software that's built in Rust internally was built using the infrastructure that I built and maintained for the language. And then, you know, I was there for about 3 years, essentially the time I was in Los Angeles. And then when I moved to Europe, I also decided to move to a European company at the same time, which was then Helsing. And so now I'm at Helsing. I'm a principal engineer there. And, you know, I can talk a little bit about Helsing here if you want, or we can dig into that later. That's up to you.
Real quickly, I think it's an interesting company. So what Helsing is, where it is, and yeah, what it does, super quickly, and then we jump into your rusty side.
Yeah, so Helsing is a software defense company. So the idea is that it is a company that develops software, and in particular AI-based software for national defense in Europe. So we build systems for augmenting human understanding of the battlefield. So the idea here is not to take AI and sort of make it make a bunch of decisions in war, but rather to help the humans who are already engaged in war or trying to prevent it, to give them better understanding of what's going on, better ability to react quickly into developing situations, and to sort of take the massive amounts of data that gets loaded onto them and give them the tools to understand that data in real time.
Fantastic. Wow. That's a very complex, interesting, and data-rich, I would say.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, from a data perspective as well, a lot of what we have to do is sort of figure out how do we even get the data that we train the AIs for in order to give meaningful and to the best extent we can, you know, non-biased or at least, you know, as useful as possible objective information to the user. And it is really complicated. It's a difficult field. Not to mention, you know, the implications of the work that we do are pretty severe. And so it is one of the first situations I've been in where I feel like I have to think very far beyond the software. It's not just about the implications of the code that I write, but it's the implication of the choices that we make as a company. And I feel like it's very empowering in a sense to feel like I sit there and make decisions that ultimately might have an impact on a larger scale, hopefully for the better.
We have so much else to talk about, John, but this burns in my mind. Is there already an oversight policy on this type of work in Europe?
It's a complicated question, in part because so Helsing operates entirely in Europe. We work in France, Germany, and the UK, and we only work with the sort of national defense of those countries. And, you know, there's a bunch of oversight both in the EU, but also within those countries. And then there's also sort of mechanisms that we have internally as a company. And all of these are, I don't want to say in tension with each other, but they all have different goals. They all have different stakeholders in them. And they all have different opinions on what is important, what is right. And some of the work that we have to do is to sort of reconcile these different standards and figure out what do we think is right. And sometimes that means, you know, pushing the boundary on, you know, holding a higher bar for what right means. So the answer in some sense is that yes, there is oversight in these areas, but that oversight is very sort of young, if you will. I think the world is still coming to grips with what AI means across our entire industry and us as humans, much less so in sort of conflict zones.
Super interesting. And yeah, as Franz mentioned, that could be a podcast in itself, but you know, we learned about you because Andres here is in love with Rust, and he brought this love for Rust to Expantia. So now also France is in love with, and some other people in the organization. And you've been working with Rust for a while now. So perhaps the one way of starting that path is data and Rust. Why, when, where in the data AI ecosystem should Rust play? If you can give us your perspective.
I think this is a fascinating question because if you could take any language that exists out there and ask the exact same set of questions, right? Like, can you use Rust? Should you use Rust? Where does Rust fit into this? And I think the trade-offs are different for every language. I think where I see Rust work particularly well in the data domain is when you have to process large amounts of data, right? So Rust is not super well suited for sort of data exploration of the kind, I just want to do some like ad hoc analysis. I just want to write a quick script to check this thing over some data set. Rust works for that, but it tends to be a little too opinionated about how to write correct code. It tends to have a decent amount of overhead for like pushing you towards writing the code in what Rust believes to be the correct way. And that's good if you're building long-lasting production system. It's not so good if you just want to crank out something that gives you the answers you're looking for. And so I think if you're trying to do like batch data analysis, you know the kind of data you're after, or you want to transform data, for example, Rust is really good for those kinds of big jobs. Less so for the sort of analytical use case, if you will, the very human-driven interactive loop. I think Rust fits less well there. And I think actually when it comes to machine learning and AI, Rust is in an interesting position where, you know, the sort of king in that space is Python. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is the first mover effect, right? Python was the first place where you got to play with a lot of these things. And therefore, it is also the best thing, right? It started being ahead and it continues to be ahead by virtue of that. And then the second one is because I think with a lot of the machine learning, especially research, you know, people just want to tweak some parameters, run it again and see how well it works. You want easy ways to, you know, plot your results, get them to images, pipe data sets through. Python is very amenable to that kind of working. But I do think we're increasingly seeing statically typed languages, I think Rust being one of them, we're seeing some C++ in this space too, taking, you know, the output of all this constant churn of figuring out what the right algorithm is, what the right structure for your neural net is, and then encoding it in something that can actually execute more efficiently. And especially then the bits that don't run on the graphics card on the GPU, but the parts in between, right? The things that transform your input, transform your outputs. Once that starts to stabilize, encoding it in a language that is in many ways more efficient than Python is can be valuable. But it does come at a cost because now it's harder to change it as well because you've encoded it in a language that is, let's say, less happy about constant churn.
Franz, Andres, I want to hear you guys here. I want to learn. So yeah. Have the Rust conversation for a while, then I'll stop you.
Yeah, so friends, I would actually love to hear your opinion. From my perspective, I 100% agree. We were actually just having a conversation about this yesterday, friends and myself, about, okay, how do we sell Rust, right? And we were just speaking, okay, we have, and it was a very specific example of, okay, there's 10 gigabytes of JSON data, right? You try to read that from R. We use a lot of R in the organization, but we also use Python. And in whichever high-level interpretive language you try to do it, you're going to bottleneck your CPU and you're going to consume 100% of your RAM, right? That's a very specific example where Rust would be a good candidate for transformation of a bunch of JSON data. But we then came at the question of like, okay, so what, right? We could deploy, I don't know, 100 nodes on Kubernetes that distributes and parses the JSON files and puts them on a data warehouse. And then I came to the argument, for example, okay, that's a very distributed system. Debugging that is going to be quite a challenge. It's not so easy to say, okay, let's just add more hardware to it. That implies something. So I would like to kind of hear your opinion and then maybe Franz. Okay, given that compute is so cheap today, how is Rust and the efficiencies of Rust going to benefit the ecosystem as a whole?
Oh, I have so many thoughts. I'm just trying to figure out where to start here. Okay, I think the first place I want to start is to recognize that there are a bunch of trade-offs in this space. I think if you start from a position of how do we sell Rust for everything everywhere, you're starting from a losing position, right? There are a bunch of things where Rust is not the right choice, and it's important to acknowledge where those places are. There are some places where it's a costly choice, but it might still be the right one. For example, if you know that you're, you know, the efficiency gains that you gain are going to be so significant that you're willing to accept the flexibility, the ergonomics cost to the developer, then that might still be a worthwhile investment, but you have to be aware of that cost, of that trade-off. I think one of the things that we also see is this tendency towards extremes. Like either you can just hack together a Python script that you run on your laptop, or you have to write like a distributed Rust program that's deployed by Kubernetes to 100 machines. And that's a false choice, right? Like there are a bunch of things in between. In fact, there's this really interesting paper from 2015, I want to say, called Scalability, But at What Cost? It's written by Frank McSherry. And it's a really interesting paper because what he does is he looks at all of these research papers and large distributed systems that people have built for, I think in this particular case, analysis of graphs, like graph processing systems. And he takes all these systems and run them on these giant data sets. Like imagine, you know, they're like 100 gigabytes or 500 gigabytes or something, giant data sets. And he goes, okay, if you run this through a giant distributed system, you give it 10 machines, it takes, you know, 4 hours to run this analysis. And then he goes, what if we instead just, I'm just going to hack together like a program locally on my computer. It's going to use multiple cores, but it's just going to be, in fact, maybe it doesn't even use multiple cores. Maybe it's single core, but I'm going to implement a bunch of smart algorithms that are easy to implement because it's all single threaded. There's no distributed system or anything. There's no overhead to network communication. And he gets these same data sets that you can just store on disk, streams them through a local program on his computer, and it finishes in like 20 minutes. And so you can either have a 10 machine distributed cluster compute for 4 hours, or you do it in 20 minutes on your computer. And I do think this is the reality of some of these big data problems, that like 100 gigabytes is not a lot of data anymore. Not really. And I think we tend to start to think, oh, we need all these fancy big data systems, when in reality, you can crank through that stuff on modern CPUs, especially if you use multiple cores, very efficiently. And it's worth not discarding those solutions early on. Just because your Python implementation or your R implementation isn't fast enough, there are incremental steps you can go rather than, okay, we need to deploy Spark now.
It's music to my ears, John. I couldn't agree more. And we've seen this in practice, right? And we've helped customers reduce their cloud bill, you know, enormously by just taking 3 steps back, rethinking about what the problem actually is. Because sometimes when you start to work, suddenly the problem is, I don't have enough RAM. And you might solve for that, but that might not be the original problem, right? The original problem is somewhere else at the start of where we started working. So fascinating to hear you explain it like you did. Very good.
I think, you know, there's another angle to this as well, which is, I do think that Rust is well suited for high performance things, but it's for two reasons. The first of them is it's a compiled language, right? That gives you a bunch of automatic benefits, and that's nice. Python is slower because it's interpreted. Okay, you get some performance benefit from that, out of the box. But the other is that the Rust community, and I think to some extent the language designers, have been very focused on this idea that it matters that when you make a trade-off, you make it in favor of performance. You see this a lot in the design of libraries like crates in the Rust ecosystem, and also in various language features, that they try really hard to not introduce extra cost, whether that's extra copying of data or, you know, extra parsing or deserialization or whatever it might be. And that culture has been so pervasive in Rust that we see this everywhere. So when you build a new library on top of some existing library, you try to avoid extra cost in your thing as well. And that does give you enormous benefits when things stack up. The downside to that mentality, though, is that Rust interfaces to libraries can be kind of painful to use because they're so focused on this sort of zero copy, no cost anywhere. Everything is, you know, compiler optimized. There's no, you know, for the technical of you, like dynamic dispatch, there's none of that. We've just like stripped it all down so it's as performant as it possibly can be. Well, to get there, you're trading off developer ergonomics. And there are a bunch of use cases where that's not really the right trade-off. Like, for example, if most of your employees are data scientists, they're not really software engineers. They're trying to get insights out of your data, manipulate your data, analyze your data, visualize it. You don't really want them to have to learn the intricacies of like zero-cost Rust code. But Rust often forces them to do that if you've written your entire data pipeline using that language. And so this is where it's really important to know your use case very well.
So you've done a lot of work, John, to help people get into those nitty-gritty details, right, with your life coding. Andreas has talked to us about that. How did you start doing that? How did you start with life coding? How did you learn to do it so well that you've created a whole community around that? How does that work?
In some sense, it's by accident. What I mean by that is in 2018 or so, you know, there's a Rust survey every year of the Rust community and the developers in the Rust community about, you know, what would you most like to see from the language, from the ecosystem, from the community. And one of the things that came up in that survey was people wanted more intermediate resources, like teaching resources for, you're no longer a beginner, you're trying to like level up and move into building real software with Rust. And so I was like, well, I know Rust decently well. At that point, I'd been working, you know, on building real Rust code for 2 or 3 years. And so I figured, well, maybe I can contribute here. I like to teach. And so I did a poll, I think, on Twitter. And at the time, I had like, you know, 3 Twitter followers or something. But I tweeted out and I was like, okay, what would be the mechanism or the medium that you would most prefer to learn intermediate Rust through? And I gave some options, and I think one of them was, you know, blog posts. One of them was well-documented code, code reviews, all of the sort of standard things that I would think of. And by far the most common response I got, and by that I mean like 3 out of 5 or something, right? What was, no, we want to see video of you coding. And this was baffling to me because video is a very low bandwidth medium in terms of information exchange, right? You have to watch it in relatively real time. People get to the point slowly and so on and so on. So it wasn't really the way I would prefer to learn or had ever taught, but I figured if this is what people want, sure, why not? And so I knew that I have to sort of hold myself to it, otherwise I'd never do it. So I bought a microphone. I bought a microphone that was like more expensive than it should have been to force myself to use it at least once. Right? Because if I didn't have that, I would probably just forget about it. But because I had it sitting there on the desk in front of me and it was expensive, I knew I had to do at least one stream. And so what I did was I just took a programming problem that I had for my PhD thesis work. So I was building this giant sort of distributed database with a built-in cache is what I built for my PhD thesis work. And as part of that, I needed I don't even remember what the first crate I built was. I think it was a crate for running a bunch of benchmarks on EC2 in an automated way and then bringing all the results back for doing my evaluation section. And I needed a thing that did that, and I didn't find anything that did that. So I sat down and just went, all right, I need to program this thing anyway. Let me just, you know, turn on screen sharing and the microphone and then talk through building it in real time. And there was a lot of appetite, I think, for seeing someone build something for real, seeing all of the ways in which they just randomly get stuck on things that might seem like simple problems after the fact. Watching how an experienced developer walks through the problem, thinks about the solution space, makes trade-offs, how they write their code, how they debug, how they get out of hard cases, how, you know, we make mistakes. Even like, no matter how experienced of a developer you are, you still make mistakes, and even stupid ones. And I think it's really helpful to people who are less experienced to watch someone more experienced just work through a real problem. You pick up a lot of things, I think, that are small techniques that I've developed for myself over the years, like how I name functions that I don't even think about. I would never write a blog post about it. But when you see me work, you get to see all these small things that wouldn't warrant sort of instructional material on their own, but all come together in this sort of end-to-end learning experience. And then over the years, you know, people found more and more value in this. I found more things I wanted to build. More requests came in for the kinds of software people wanted to see me build, or specific topics that I touched on a lot and they wanted a deep dive on. And so I just kept, you know, developing the teaching resources that I thought people would find useful. And I think that's resonated over time to the point where now, you know, there's a decent number of people who find the stuff that I put out there useful and contribute back ideas for how I could make more useful stuff to more people.
Yeah, a very interesting way of, I can imagine you, and by the way, Andres is also doing some live codings in Spanish now. And so you guys then coding something yourself and still talking out loud just because you're accustomed now to share what you're thinking and doing. But look, I think that this idea of building a community and doing live coding and sharing how you're thinking through a problem is fantastic. And I think that gives life to the Rust community somehow. I was going to bring you onto a kind of topic that we see a lot in Latin America. I think it's in general, but when you think about open source, right, and then solving problems at enterprise level, there's all this mystique about security and why this may or may not be safe. If you can demystify that, I know that you've also been talking a lot about that and just told us about your approach to this. So is it something that you can quickly bring us on board?
I mean, this is also something we could have a whole dedicated podcast on.
This one is a summary of everything, and then we're going to get...
it's a deep and nuanced and complex set of problems. I think there are... I'm going to guess that there are two, and I'll see whether I end up at two or three or four. But roughly two things that are important when it comes to the intersection between enterprise and open source. One of them is, as an enterprise customer, taking dependencies on open source stuff is a risk, right? Because it means that you have dependencies on code that you do not control. And you might have some ways where you can modify the code after bringing it in, subject to licensing and all that. But you have you now have a bunch of stuff where you depend on other people for them to do the right thing, and you don't have a direct financial or contractual relationship with them. And so you can't force them to do the right thing. You just have to kind of hope that they do. And this is very, very uncomfortable to businesses, right? They don't like having that risk. And it is a risk, right? As we've seen time and time and time again, you end up with these risks escalating into true problems in the open source space, right? Like supply chain security incidents happen in the open source community with, I don't want to say very regularly, but they happen regularly enough. And it's because of the second problem, which is that open source is extremely underfunded, given the amount of value that they give to businesses worldwide. And I think underfunding here is not just a monetary problem. It is also a people problem. Realistically, maintaining software to a high standard requires that people are able to spend a bunch of hours on it, and B, it is not just one person. There are multiple people working together and making that thing the best they can, sort of covering for each other, double checking each other's work. And without a means to sustain that kind of work that's needed to keep a high quality open source software suffers. That's how you end up with these supply chain security problems, is because you have open source projects that have a single maintainer that's burnt out, that is not paid for that work, does not have the time anymore. And then someone else comes in and goes, sure, I'll help you, and then does something malicious. That's not the only way that things will happen, but that is one, failure case that we've seen very recently as well. And these two problems combined make for a terrible combination, right? It means that companies don't really trust open source, but they need it, right? Like, it is very costly to build things yourself, and now you're on the hook for the entire maintenance burden yourself. Very, very costly, and arguably even riskier to do it yourself. So you have to depend on this open source stuff. But the open source stuff is underfunded and therefore is not as high quality as it should be. It's a higher risk moment. And because of that, the companies are not willing to invest money into it because they're worried that that investment goes nowhere, that money, that is just money they're pouring out that they're never going to get anything back from. What they want is to give money to open source and then be able to force the open source maintainers to do what the company needs. That's how they're used to having contractual and economic relationships with other developers. But for open source, that doesn't really work. The money that needs to go into open source is not, develop this feature for my company. It is just make sure that this software is stable, well-maintained, has a sort of a chain of custody, does the regular maintenance when it comes to security updates. And that's not money that companies see a lot of value that they get back from. And often, you really need lots of companies to pay a little bit in order to make it sustainable, as opposed to one company pay a lot, because then they have too much leverage over the open source maintainer. And so you end up with this really weird, almost like game theoretical problem of neither side trusts each other or likes how each other operates. And yet, if they don't work together, everything sucks. And, you know, that there are a bunch of people trying different strategies for how to improve this problem. But I don't think we have a sound strategy for how to just solve supply chain security.
So then what? Oh, yeah, Andres, you were going to ask.
Yeah, I was going to say, okay, so then what can companies do, businesses do to improve that situation, to have a little bit more trust, not exactly on the upstream project, but how can they have a little bit of confidence that what they're doing has at least a sound level of security, and that you can actually, again, as you mentioned, you have to use open source, especially us, we work with data. Most data analytics tools are open source, and we deal with open source, I think, on average, way more than the average enterprise. So how can we, as data people, show companies that they can trust in a certain way? How is that dynamic?
I think the way that you do it is twofold. First, you identify what are all the dependencies that you have on open source things. Like, knowledge is the first problem, right? You need to have the data about what you depend on. And getting that data, you know, there's a bunch of tooling for this, for essentially analyzing your open source dependencies or your entire dependency graph. And that includes, you know, not just the libraries you directly depend on. It includes like command line tools, operating system implementations, data formats, all of the software stack that you're depending upon, you need to have visibility into. Once you have that, you then need to look across that stack and look at where is there need. So where is it that, you know, if we look at this giant graph, where are places that we think that they are suboptimal? We think there's risk. We think, you know, there's not enough people, or, you know, this has been completely deprecated. It hasn't seen updates in years. And also, where is particularly critical to us? Where are the things in that dependency graph where if this thing went bust or if this thing had a security problem, we would be on the hook. We would have a significant problem. And what you're looking for is the intersection of the two, places where it matters a lot to you that a given project doesn't fail, but also that project has a significant need. And then you find that intersection and you try to find ways to sort of boost the health of whatever those dependencies are. And there are a lot of ways to do that. One of them is to just directly be a part of sponsoring the people who work on it. You know, GitHub sponsors is one example of this, where, you know, you have to come up with some budget for you as a company of how much you're willing to pitch in essentially to your open source dependencies. And then you have to figure out how to distribute that amongst the ones that have need and risk for you. And there's not an obvious way to figure out, you know, how many dollars is this dependency worth versus that one. You can just divide it evenly, or you can try to think more about it. This is sort of an endless rabbit hole where you can go as deep as you want and as sophisticated as you want. But the starting point is to identify the things that are a risk for you, the project has a need, and then you find a way to contribute to that. That could also be going to help that project. Probably not by sending PRs. That tends to just add more maintenance burden to the project, but help them with things like reviewing existing PRs or triaging the issues that they have, or, you know, providing sponsorship to the maintainers, or, you know, providing resources to them. It could be things like, we'll cover the cost of your CI. There are ways to sort of help an open source project that are not necessarily just, you know, pay someone full time to work on it. Although if you can do that too, that's great. But oftentimes it's hard to, you know, make up for the salary of someone working on something full time.
One doubt after what I heard, guys, is, yeah, this talks well to the 1,000 companies in the world that can go and spend the time and invest some resources and people. But how about the other trillion, not trillion, but...
I have an opinion there, Diego. So, okay. I mean, in our trainings, what we do is we teach people how to identify a package to include in their project. If it has not been touched for 3 years, don't use it, because it means that somebody else wrote something new that probably is better. At least it's maintained. So check whether it's maintained. make a custom of opening the GitHub repo. If the code looks like something you wouldn't, that's not palatable, then probably the package is no good. And you don't need to be an expert coder to recognize horrible stuff, right? If it doesn't look good, don't use it. And those are things that in some spaces, it's one of my arguments, John, maybe you don't agree, I'd be interested to hear it. It's easier in R, for instance, because it's harder to publish your package and there are less packages. I think we're running around, 15,000. In Python, there's like 750,000 packages on PyPy. So that means that there's a lot of cruft, a lot of things that maybe shouldn't be there anymore. And it requires you to actually do that check more substantially because the community is less centered around one thing, right? The big advantage of having a domain-specific language is that you have a community focused on a domain. If that's not the case, then Diego, all bets are off.
I think that's true. I think having a domain-specific language helps you here because you have a more tailored community and you have fewer people around, fewer kitchens, so to speak. And at the same time, I think one of the things you have to look out for is that the open source community is a constantly shifting thing, right? So even if you look at a package today and its last commit was yesterday, then in a year or two from now, that might have been the last commit ever. And so you do have to have either processes or ideally mechanisms in place for looking for these things. And I actually think you have to be careful about automating it too much too, because if you have a tool that just, anything where the last commit is more than a year ago, flag it as don't use. Well, there are some things that are pretty stable and it's actually fine if it hasn't been updated in a year. There are some places where, maybe it hasn't been updated in a year because the project is going through a breaking change that's happening on a branch somewhere. And so it often requires some kind of human analysis, but it does require some automation to flag you. Here are things you should probably take a look at. And again, this is where it gets into a rabbit hole, right? If you take a dependency especially in like JavaScript land with Node.js, you're going to end up with a dependency closure, like a dependency tree that's huge. And realistically, you have no way for a human to just look through the entire dependency closure. Like as necessary as it might sound, it's just not feasible. And the solution to that is A, look near the sort of bottom of your dependency graph, because your direct dependencies you depend on more, but B, try to find some kind of automated analysis for what are the things that you depend on the most, which things are most critical, and then follow those paths rather than just trying to look at everything, because it's just not feasible.
Lovely. And by the way, this brings me to two last questions. One is about the future, then we're going to get back to the present. But now that I heard you about different languages, different types of thinking about, by the way, architecture of systems, and now the complexity of too much data to process or a lot of data to process, I think that we evolved from not thinking or thinking very hard about how to build systems to then, look, there's infinite resources, just build something and then we're going to put infinite resources. Now we're getting back to, we have to be fine-tuned. So how do you see the future thinking about data science and data engineers working together to create solutions that make a lot of sense? And by the way, adding all these security aspects that you mentioned now, what's ahead?
I think one of the things that we need here are better mechanisms. Like we need tooling that helps us do this kind of analysis. And again, not fully automated tooling, not something that tells you, put X dollars here, but rather something that lets you explore your dependency graph, mark which things are most important to you, highlight things that are worth, a human going to look at. And that kind of tooling is really, really important for the supply chain security side of things. We've seen a couple of startups that are trying to build tools like this. I haven't seen any that solve the problem. I think there are similar problems in the funding space. Like it's actually really hard to pay people if you don't have them as full-time employees. GitHub sponsors is sort of one decent way to do this, but it doesn't have a lot of transparency into where that money goes. It doesn't have a lot of, reporting back. It's very ad hoc, the bar you can hold people to when you contribute in that way. So then you have things like Open Collective, which tries to have all this transparency reporting around it. But I feel like we still don't have the right model for how to pay for open source. And again, there are a bunch of people exploring it, but I don't think we have any hard and fast answers. And that's one of the things I hope that in the future we'll get more clarity on. When it comes to data science, I think we're actually on a pretty decent path. I think R, for example, did a lot of good things for the more interactive use of data exploration, similar to, you know, Python with pandas and data frames and all of that is a good way to work interactively with data. I don't know that we've seen the end of it. I think one of the things we still have is this, you know, you still have to write a bunch of code in order to explore data efficiently. And that applies both to processing the data, but also visualizing the data and deciding how to visualize. This is one of the places where I'm hoping that, you know, AI and ML might be able to help. I don't think it's going to tell you, you can conclude the following things from your data. I don't actually see it have that kind of intuition or knowledge. But I think where it might help you is, you know, automating how do you parse this data? Automating what are, like, give me five different visualizations of this data. So that kind of automating away the thing a human would do anyway if they were to try to explore this data themselves. So I'm hoping that we get some better automated tooling for data exploration and data analysis and data parsing. When it comes to at scale processing of data, here too, I think that we saw, you know, a huge shift of people moving to Spark for a while in these sort of big distributed systems. And to touch on the earlier point, I think we're now seeing at least an understanding that there are a bunch of problems where running a giant distributed system isn't necessarily the best thing either. You can move to something that is more tailored to your use case and still actually performs better and is cheaper to run. And where we end up in that cycle, I'm not sure. You know, it could be that we now fall all the way back to every developer just hacks together R scripts locally and R is just fast enough. But there is a pendulum swinging here and I don't know exactly where we're going to land.
Lovely. Interesting. Any comments, Andres, Franz, or else I'm going to come back to the present.
No, just to a last point on what you said. For example, we here at Expanded, we've worked on some quite challenging data problems, and Rust, for example, and that's a point I think you didn't mention. We've built our libraries that on the back end just link to Rust, right? And we use Rust as leverage to make R faster. And that's also been done in Python. That's even been done in JavaScript with Wasm nowadays. And I think Rust is a great candidate for that, linking back to the very nitty gritty performance, like performance critical parts of the code, and leaving like the very high level data exploration part on the interactive consoles. I know you've played with ggplot, and I just don't see, for example, you doing that in any other place rather than like an R or a Python. So I think that's also like a cool place where Rust plays. And that's, for us, it's given us a lot of value, at least.
I think that's a great point. I think you're totally right to mention it as a, you know, a way where we might be able to get the benefits of both worlds, right? So you have Rust to accelerate particular workflows that, you know, are common, and then use the languages that are better suited for interactivity to sort of be the glue between those bigger bits of processing. Totally right. I agree with you there. And I think we're only really scratching the surface here. We have had, you know, native C modules in Python, for example, for a long time, and they've been used to great effect. It is one of the reasons why Python works so well, is because you can accelerate the important but slow parts by making them native modules. And I think Rust takes that one step further by making it easier to do that safely or do that correctly than it was before. Whether it necessarily completely changes the ball game, I'm not sure, right? We have been able to do this before, but I think Rust has sort of pushed the envelope on making sure that this is easy for a lot of languages, right? We see really good interoperability between Rust and Python. We see really good interoperability between Rust and ergonomic interoperability between Rust and JavaScript with Wasm. And I haven't looked at the interoperability between Rust and R, but I could imagine it's similarly.
It's pretty cool. We love it.
Yep.
Look, last question. Coming back to the present, and if I think about your world, guys, the three of you, thinking about what's going on with engineering and with science and mixing all that and learning as fast as you can and as good as you can and enjoying that, by the way. So in your particular case, John, I'm interested in learning how you learn. What's your approach? Is it just coding, making mistakes, learning from them, going to conferences, talking, live coding? What are your mechanisms to be up to date?
It's a combination of all of the above. So especially during my PhD, I went to a bunch of academic conferences, but they were academic conferences that were very sort of close to production or close to real systems. So I went to conferences like SOSP and OSDI, which are both academic systems conferences that are very focused on building real systems and measuring real systems. We get a lot of people from industry, for example, coming and presenting the system that they've built, like, you know, Google or Facebook or Amazon, like the big systems they've built. They come there to talk about the designs of them. And I think that's a good environment to be in. Even if you can't attend the conferences, like the conferences are often, you know, far away or they're expensive or both, looking at the papers that come out of the top academic conferences for the kinds of areas you care about, whether that is databases, data science, programming languages, distributed systems, operating systems, but keeping an eye on academic papers, I think is actually a really good idea because it both gives you the forward-looking eye for what are technologies that people are thinking of but don't necessarily exist yet. And it also gives you the what are companies proud that they're doing angle on things. Because a company is not going to come to a conference and present a piece of software that's not that interesting, right? They wouldn't get into the conference in the first place. So they're showing real systems that are solving real problems for them at scale. And it can be super interesting to learn from those. Now, learning to read academic papers is a skill and it takes a little while to develop. Initially, there's just a lot of text, a little bit hard to read language, hard graphs to follow, but just start, right? Like start by reading the abstract, the introduction and the evaluation and nothing else, just to get a sense for what is this system? What are they proposing? What kind of problems are they tackling? And roughly how well did they do? And then over time, you can start to dig more into the papers you care about. And don't be afraid to just discard a paper and go like, this is not interesting to me. Almost like based on the title or the abstract, you should be able to filter out pretty quickly which subset of the many papers at these conferences are actually relevant to you. And then I think the second part is, at least for me, is to go to Rust conferences. Very often the Rust conferences, especially the ones that are geared more towards, you know, industry users like Rust Nation and Eurorust, I think those are really good at, you know, having people talk about using Rust for real things. Again, having companies come in and talk about what did Rust do for them. And often the things they talk about aren't necessarily about Rust specifically. Like, yes, they're using Rust, but they're talking about just software engineering for solving real business problems. And I think that can be a valuable thing to learn from. And if you're a programmer who's sort of more in the R space than in the Rust space, then look for the equivalent for your language, right? Find an R conference or a data science conference and go to that. Similarly, for I think meetups are another way to do this because they might be smaller, they might not meet as often, they might not be as sort of meaty of a technical density there. But at the same time, just meeting people who are outside your current sphere, your current little sort of bubble, if you will, and then talking to them about your field can be a great way to learn things, both things that they know that you don't, but also for them to give you pointers to things that you can then go read, right? This is how you discover new sources of information. And I think, you know, to tie into that, a big way that I discover new things is the sort of social media platforms, be that, you know, Twitter or Mastodon or LinkedIn. Over the years, I've sort of accumulated many of those people I've spoken to once and they said something interesting. And then they've told me about this other person that I should also check out and they're interesting. And any one of those people, maybe they post something once a month or once a year, that those are actually the perfect people because they have something they care so much about that it's very rare they post something. But when they do, I know it's an article worth reading. And what I've ended up with is something that's very tailored to like the particular subset of fields that I care about. But I think constructing that graph over time is pretty worthwhile.
No, fantastic. Fantastic. Look, I admire you guys. You're solving interesting problems and you're super passionate about what you're doing. So being up to date on this is fantastic. By the way, we got to the worst part of this podcast, which is the end. This was fantastic, John. Thanks so much for the time. I think we're going to try to do a double down on one of the topics, or at least some of the topics we covered today. But for now, thanks so much for the time.
No, thank you for having me. It was really interesting. I hope I haven't rambled too much, and there was actually mostly interesting to most people.
We covered a lot of cool topics, so I think it's going to be a must listen to a lot of developers and people doing cool stuff with data. Thanks so much, John. Until next time.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Bye. Take care.
Gracias por acompañarnos en nuestra exploración del mundo de ciencia de datos en este Data Latam Podcast. Cada dos semanas encontrarás un nuevo episodio en datalatam.com o iTunes. Si te gustó este podcast, déjanos comentarios en Facebook.